We have a rather controversial subject this morning, and I believe that it has practical value at the present time when the world seems to be filled with anxieties. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is stated that the mind is the slayer of the real. This concept was carried over into Buddhism very strongly. And the entire problem in Buddhist philosophy is founded upon the need for a complete reorganization of the relationship of the human being to his own mind. So in the light of that, we will begin a study which perhaps is not entirely orthodox Hinduism. I'm not sure that it's orthodox anything, but it's the way it looks at the moment, and we'll share it with you. Actually, the human mind creates most of the situations with which we are faced. Our civilization is a product of mind. Science, culture, art, music, literature, all these arise in the human mind. The mind is an incredible instrument, and we cannot for a moment discount its contributions. But when we sum them all up, we realize that the mind has certain deficiencies, that the mind is a useful servant. It is an accountant and a bookkeeper, a financial expert, all these things. But it is not able to guide its own course toward truth. Truth and mind have been at points of difference for a very long time. Mind leads to things as they are. And if we are willing to accept things as they are, as truth, then we may declare ourselves to be mentalists. But the question remains, are these things which are now so familiar to us actually true? This seems to be a point in which the Stoics and the Cynics would differ from the existentialists of today. Let us then ask ourselves, what is the principal predicament that faces us? Well, one of the very prime answers to that is difference of opinion. You can go up and down the world, and you will find that each individual has certain opinions of his own, and he is far more concerned with sustaining these opinions than he is in the search for truth. Of course, this matter is passed over lightly, because to each individual, his own opinion is the truth. But there's something wrong with the concept, because if each person's opinion is the truth, the confusion is worse confounded. There is no possible way of organizing these innumerable differences in religion, philosophy, science, and all the arts, in history, geography, politics, all these things, differences of opinion are innumerable. All this points out another very interesting possibility. All these arise in the mind. And if the mind is continually breeding differences forever, and is in conflict with its own particular productions, so that the mind of one fights the mind of another, then there's something that needs further consideration concerning the place of the mind in the history of the world. I think it is safe to say that at the present time, most of the present muddle is mental. Some persons, many, are frightened to death, and fear in itself, anxieties arise in the mind. Other persons are quite certain that everything is being done badly. This is a conviction in their own minds and is opposed to similar but opposite convictions in other minds. The mind also predicts the future, filling us all with further fear and discontent. Projecting our present thinking, we come to some very sad and doleful possibilities lying ahead. Also, the mind tells us what success is, what it requires, and how we should approach it. The mind strengthens ambitions and gives techniques for the advancement of personal ends. The mind also is a great salesman. It is a governor in its own right, and the mind, under one body or another, sits in every chair of government in the world. All things are governed by the mind through the minds of governors. So this mind gets to be a pretty important factor in existence, possibly the most important to an embodied world. Now, if there is any question as to the validity of the mind, then we should begin to give consideration to the mental equipment and how we are supposed to use it. One of the points that Marcus Aurelius makes in his Meditations is that the most useful contribution mind can make is long-range planning. Whenever a person performs an action, no matter how simple or complicated the single action may be, it must have a consequence. And the moment the action is performed, the consequence should be considered. Now, this is completely contrary to present policy. Today, we think in terms of do as we please now, and the devil take the hindmost. We make no long-range study of our problems. And we perform whatever action is convenient, comfortable, or pleasant at the moment, with no consideration of the place of this action in the common action of mankind. So Marcus Aurelius was quite correct when he pointed out that almost everything we do has consequences. And the individual performing an action should be sufficiently intelligent to consider the consequence even before he performs the action. And if the consequence of the action is obviously wrong, he will not perform that action. If this was applied to present world conditions, things would be practically solved. Because everything that we do is in terms of immediate profit or immediate satisfaction or immediate comfort. The consequences are given no consideration at all. The present lack of basic environmental utilities is a proof of this. The problem of food is a proof of short-sightedness and indifference to consequences. Almost all ecological difficulties arise from immediate waste without thought. So everywhere the person is not using the mind as it should be used. He is allowing the mind to devote itself largely to pleasing and fulfilling the ambitions of its owner. This was not the original use of mind. It was not created for this purpose. It was a guide, but it has become an employment by means of which we fulfill our appetites. Now, if we consider the matter in the terms, perhaps, of Oriental philosophy, we can say then that the mind, and this I think is an important point, that the mind itself can destroy only the products of itself. In other words, whatever the mind creates that is wrong, the mind itself can and will destroy. Any illusion that passes for truth will ultimately be exposed. Actually, the mind cannot, however, destroy the natural world. The human mind has no essential influence upon the infinite plan of things. It can only affect the little patterns that it sets itself. It can move a civilization into limbo because it put it there in the first place. It can change the destiny of the individual if he allows it to guide his conduct. And if his mind fails him or is wrong, the consequences are pernicious. The mind, however, cannot touch infinite law. So in the Orient, Chinese, Hindu, Buddhist, we find a certain concept that there is a reality. This reality may be regarded as infinite will. It is distributed throughout every atom of space. It is everywhere, in everything, always. And it is unchangeable. It cannot be altered, compromised, or exploited. Any effort to go against the divine will by the human mind must end in disaster. The mind was made to obey the laws which it learns. And one of the purposes of the mind is to help to educate us as to the universal divine plan of things. The mind is to show us how the infinite wants it done. Instead of that, we use it, in a sense, to take over the divine pattern and reform that which in itself is unchangeable. There is no evidence that the universal laws have ever changed in the slightest degree. They have become more apparent at some times than at others. They have been interpreted in innumerable ways by various cultures, usually by minds determined to adapt or apply universal energy to private purpose. But actually, the laws themselves never change. The infinite purpose cannot be disturbed by the action of human will or intention. If then we are really concerned with solving something, we must try to discover what the law of that thing is. And that law is not enacted or maintained or variously amended by the Supreme Court. That law is the will of the infinite for that which it has brought forth out of itself by the application of its own laws. So we live unlawfully in a lawful universe and somehow feel that we can succeed in living our own way regardless of its relationship to the infinite will. Again, Marcus Aurelius points out very definitely that the patterns by which we live, if analyzed carefully, are supremely stupid. Practically everything that we do is foolish. Our motives are foolish. Our objectives are foolish. The whole pattern of our way of existing in our present way is to overlook and forget the law and emphasize the comforts. Each individual is surrounded by certain inevitable facts, and he tries to forget these to the best of his ability. But even though forgotten by his conscious mind, they're in no way weakened, altered, or removed as patterns of power. Man is born, and man suffers, and man dies. And in the interval between birth and death, there are years, sometimes a few, sometimes many. In these years, certain experiences are possible to the human being. And one of the questions we must ask, if we are thoughtful, is what did the infinite will determine that we should do with the finite years of our own living. If we live in this world 80 or 85 or 90 years, what were we put here to do? Now, we very carefully avoid this question in practice. We are not interested in what we were put here to do. We are interested in doing as we please as long as we can. We are not wise enough or long range enough to take care of ourselves properly. And there are thousands, millions of people every day who are shortening their own lives by their own foolishness. But this has no basic effect upon their thinking. Also, many build these years of life into programs which finally make them unfit for creative thinking. They cannot think solutionally of anything except stocks, bonds, and real estate. The stocks, we know what their futures are, and we know also the bonds are just a cut better sometimes. And as far as real estate is concerned, we will ultimately inherit only the plot in which we are buried. All the rest goes to other purposes. And today, due to the expensive and scarcity of land, cremation is taking over, and our ashes will be dumped in the ocean. We can no longer afford even the ground for a grave. And yet we are talking constantly, and $1 million worth of this, $1 billion worth of that, and the importance of having an adequate munition with which to support and protect what we have. There are no munitions in the world that could be as protective as common sense. But we have not yet come to that degree in our thinking. Marcus Aurelius, at the end of the first chapter of his little meditation, says that fame is no more important than oblivion. Because if it is true that we depart from here, any reputation that we may leave behind has no value for us after we are gone. We may live magnificently as far as our own thinking is concerned, but if there is any reputation that will endure at all, it is not our estate but our conduct which will ultimately be honored. And it is the honoring of conduct that is one of the rarer things that we have. And because we are embarrassed and ashamed of our own conduct, we spend time now, year after year, tearing down the conducts of those whom we admired previously, simply to bring them down to our own level. Now, with this mind problem, what are we doing? How are we going to handle this problem of our own careers? If mind is not the ruler, then what is? Actually, the Buddhist opinion on this matter is rather, I think, simple. Namely, that to the degree that we relax the intellect and permit the internal part of ourselves to come through, to that degree, desirelessness leads to truth. Desire is forever between us and truth. In the cause of desire, we compromise truth every moment of our lives. And we make it a law, practically, to pervert realities in order to advance careers. And we penalize the individual who lives as he should. Now, this penalizing process is most discouraging. But at the same time, it is not an excuse for compromise. Compromising is a means of putting ourselves into those patterns which are destined to fail. Compromise makes us one with the grand mistake of mankind. It gives us no future. It promises nothing but ultimate disaster. So in the Oriental system, we come into a pattern in which the plan, Taoism, the plan, must be allowed to shine through. What we want is not important. What must be and should be is all important. And if it interferes with personal success, that personal success is best interfered with. We are working toward a realization of something. Now, in our daily living, in these complicated eras, we are slowly becoming aware that what we are doing is not working. We also know that it has been tried for 10,000 years and has never worked. And how a person can call themselves a thinker or a scientist or an executive and continue to make the same mistakes that all of his kind have made since the dawn of time is difficult to understand. But it is part of this philosophy of immediacy. The future, so what? The most important thing is now. We must have it today. We must finish it today. For somehow we realize that even tomorrow is uncertain. So in this particular phase of living, we are now under a new threat. A few years ago, the atomic bomb was exploded for the first time. And for all intent and purposes, that explosion, or those explosions, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, were the end of human complacency. From that time on, fear began to develop within the human being. He discovered that his ingenuity has enabled him to create a means of self-destruction that is more astonishing and more final than anything he ever knew before. It was bad enough when he threw rocks at his enemies. It was even worse when he used bows and arrows against his friends. But now, the imminent development of a means of universal destruction has caused a great deal of fear. Now, fear is a negative emotion. It is something that in itself is comparatively worthless. Fear perhaps gives us some protection against extreme foolishness. But as a means of solving our problems, it is of no importance. But fear is there. But fear is not leading us to correct the cause. Instead of our fear causing us to find some solution, fear is leading to the multiplication of nuclear armament to make sure that everybody has more than they know what to do with of the power to destroy themselves. Now, this would be a very tragic thing, except as the Orientalist suddenly realizes, and has always believed, namely that anything that can be destroyed by the nuclear bomb will die anyway. This is something that we haven't taken into consideration. Namely, that the whole structure is locked within matter, material things, cities, towns, institutions, races, nations, political systems. All these things are physical, material things. Wealth is a physical thing. War is a physical thing. These are all part of nature, which we call material, physical, belonging to this world, part of the corporeal structure of life. Some years ago, when the atomic bomb was still in its earliest stages, I knew a number of persons who built bomb shelters. They thought they were really long-range thinking. They never really studied the problem of the shelter they were building. Some fast salesman sold them the idea. But actually, the whole theory was comparatively worthless. It was another phase of mental escapism. Most of the persons whom I knew that built those bomb shelters to protect them against the fiery death from the sky, most of them are already dead, and they've died in their beds. And the bomb shelters are now used for garden tools, or for food storage, or as a playpen for children. The fear had no effect upon the life expectancy of those people. Perhaps they felt a little safer with the shelter, but it never had anything to do with it. Every day, many, many times as many persons die of natural causes as died in the original atomic explosions. We are killing more people today on the highways with drunken drivers than it is at all likely we will lose in the next world war, if there is one. The individual doesn't measure things. He doesn't think anything through. He doesn't realize the mayhem on the highways. He doesn't realize that while he is frightened to death of a nuclear bomb, he is perfectly willing to drive a high-powered car under the influence of alcohol. He doesn't fear to kill himself by drink. But the idea that it might happen from the bomb touches him to the very soul of his nature. Here again, we are in the face of the Oriental point of view. Anything that happens in the material world is subject to the function of man's mortal mind. The only way he can get away from his difficulties in this world is to properly educate his mind. And the only way he can educate his mind correctly is to train it to recognize that there is something in the universe more important than mind. Mind has to take a secondary relationship with life. While it is primary, we will be in trouble forever. Mind, therefore, in a sense, stands between each of us and the realities which could bring us security and happiness. Mind has set up a conspiracy. He has set up a vast organization of ulterior motives. It has turned us in from the very depths of speculation and monetary fantasy into the complete waste of time in front of a television set. These things indicate a mind gone to seed, or perhaps we should say a mind that never got even as far as a seed in the life of the average owner. So while we sit around desponding over things, we have within our cranium a small cell that seems to be continually selling us out, making life more meaningless, more dangerous, more destructive than ever before in history. And yet people, all in all, are good. People are kindly. They want to do the right thing. Most individuals will do anything that seems to be right as long as it doesn't consequently result in too much loss for himself. But good-hearted, in an emergency, they come forward like heroes. Someone in trouble, there's always someone there to help. We are ready to feed the suffering and the hungry, take care of the sick. Individually, the human beings are good. But they are under a mental collective pattern that has been bestowed upon them by their ancestors and supported by their education, and apparently made necessary by competitive economic policies. And under these, the individual sells out his birthright. He completely fails to recognize that he has responsibilities for the use of his mental equipment. The Oriental, trying to figure out just how to handle this situation, has finally come to the conclusion that about the best thing to do is to detach oneself from the confusion of worldliness. But this doesn't really work too well either, because when we walk out of worldliness, we move into the mountain somewhere and build a cabin, we fail to realize that we take the worldliness with us into that cabin because it is in ourselves. So we then begin to suffer various privations for principles. We deny ourselves common comforts and develop a whole negative system of mental frustrations which solve nothing either. The mind has just settled in on us like a real tyrant. It has become an obsessor of our lives and values. Also, it has dominated us very largely by stimulating fear. It, of course, also attacks and undermines the other basic freedoms of human life, but fear makes it impossible for us to change our ways. Fear causes us to believe that change may be more painful than what we have. Fear is also exploited by those who wish us to remain as we are. And fear in our personal lives stands between us and the major decisions that would help us to solve our problems. We all need a mental overhaul. And for a time it was hoped that psychology would give it to us. But psychology has not been dedicated to the solution of mental problems. It has rather become a kind of justification for mental attitudes that are wrong but generally accepted. We are still very much in the same condition. The mind continues to slay the realities of life. Now, is there any way out of this particular situation? Yes, there probably is a way out. But it's a way out that appears to be forced upon us by an aggrieved providence. Look out into space, and we are now beginning to fill space with menace. Once we regarded space as a kind of dome, and over the top of it was heaven, with angels and the divine Trinity and the sources of life. Today we are talking about black holes which swallow up cosmic systems. And we have science fiction to support this, and we have some tremendous motion pictures to prove that the universe hates us heartily and was hardly able to wait till it can eliminate us. Nearly all visitors from other planets are assumed to be dangerous. Or if they are not dangerous, they are strange, mysterious-looking things that do not appear as though they would be much competition. Actually, we are afraid of space. We are afraid of everything. We have not discovered in our own hearts and minds that we are part of an indestructible expanse of life, that space from one end to the other is immeasurable. It is all suspended from powers inconceivable. It functions by laws immutable. This mysterious thing that we call space goes on through light years and light ages. It is filled with living things. And over these living things, the human being has no power whatsoever. The only authority he has is attempting to take over the proprietorship of this little molehill which we call the Earth. But even if he takes it over, what does it mean? It means that he is on a small island somewhere in the edge of an infinite ocean. Even if he should conquer the planet, what does he have? Nothing. And when he does finally conquer it, he has a few years, and then he must lie down and be conquered by the very earth he has taken over. The whole thing is completely beyond his control. He cannot change the infinite way. He cannot alter the great motions of the thousands and millions of suns and their planets way out yonder. He cannot even count the stars in the Milky Way. Every time he has a new telescope, he finds more stars. They go on and on and on. Hypothetically and scientifically, we say we have conquered space when we put a small projectile out there a few miles and feel that we have actually outwitted the ages. Nothing has changed. We are still exactly what we were. Our link with reality is our only value. It is the fact that somewhere lurking within ourselves is that unit of power which sustains all things. This is our wealth. This is our treasure. This is the reason for our existence and the means of that existence. We can never conquer anything except our own ignorance. And we can only conquer that when we use the whole creation as a vast symbol of an infinite power which we must obey. We cannot take over. We do not even know the morality of space. We do not know what is good and what is bad way out there. We measure all things in terms of our own comforts and discomforts. We do not know whether those planets that disappear and those stars that fade away actually die, or whether, like the human being, they pass out of a body to be born again. We can find no death in space. We are not at all sure we can even find it here. But what we call death is a change of worlds, but is it a change of condition? We do not know. We have dropped a body, but this does not mean that we have died. So with all the uncertainties and all the fears of them, with millions of people fearing life and hundreds of millions fearing death, what have we accomplished? We are fools as we were before, as Faust says. We have not understood or given our attention to the final solution of things. Now, the final solution of things is also a matter of acceptances. When a person follows a wrong pattern for enough years, a good pattern will hurt him or make him feel uncomfortable. He will not want to change, even though he realizes that his present course is fatal. He does not want to understand life, even though he knows that he must sometime face a change. He is just beginning to think seriously about life after death. And he is not yet able to create a philosophical insight or a mystical insight strong enough to comfort him in the years as they come to an end. All of this is part of a little plan, a little pattern which we have to live by within the great pattern. And our only great hope or ability to handle this situation is through the complete reorganization of the processes of the mind. We've got to do something to get the tyranny of the mind off of our backs, for it rides us as the old man of the sea in the story of Sinbad the Sailor. Now, in this problem also, we have another factor. What is this mysterious energy that is released by the bomb? Years ago, we had here on the Los Angeles Times a science commentator who wrote a daily column. I think his name was Lal, and he was a Hindu. But he wrote for many years. And I remember that in one of his columns, he discussed the fact that it appears that the ancient Hindus knew about the atomic bomb. He said, for example, and I suppose anyone who wants to can check it, that in the Ramayana, which is one of the great classics of India, it's a sort of a like the Odyssey and the Iliad of the Greeks, a magnificent epic poem, that in the Ramayana, Sita, the wife of the avatar Rama, is kidnapped and taken to the island of Lanka, Ceylon, which has now become Lanka again, by an evil king known as Ravana. And Rama gathered a great army and gained the assistance of the king of the apes. And altogether they built a bridge and invaded Lanka and rescued Sita. But the point that is interesting is that it is said in the book that Ravana, the evil king of Lanka, became so angry when he realized that his cause had failed, that he shouted and screamed and tore and went about with such terrific combustion that, to use the statement in the book, it was as though an atom had been split. Now, whether this is understood correctly or not, we don't know, but it is an interesting thought that when you get very angry, go into hysteria, maybe some kind of an atom is getting split. There is an irrational release of energy. There is a tremendous power breaking through that is going nowhere. A great temper fit is a tremendous tempest. Perhaps it is an atomic bomb to the physical body. And if it gets far enough out socially, it can be a bomb disrupting society. A false, negative, destructive release of energy from within ourselves can be fatal, not only to our own lives, but to perhaps the whole society to which we belong. Therefore, the problem, first of all, to follow the Buddhist concept, would be that the individual has no reason to fear the bomb, or fear any of the types of emergency that result from Ravana becoming angry. Actually, there is no essential difference.